Oh, yes, that's what I wanted to share with you. Sun's meditative, The Holy Quiet, was inspired by the tragic shootings in Charleston. Yeah, it was very raucous in the beginning, very kind of disturbing. So the piece captures the sorrow and anger invoked by the terrible incident with a percussive clamor, featuring both Sun and Palmetto joining Hershkowitz, while Wilson intones a harrowing bowed howl. A driving rock beat fuels Palmetto's more lighthearted tune. Well, that's another one. So yeah, that was a very bizarre kind of sound. Okay, so let's see. I think we'll go to some different flavors in just a bit. It's WMFO Medford here live from Tufts University, and you are listening to The Voice Mobile. I'm your host, Joyce The Voice, trying to put the CD in a way that it's not meant to open. Okay. So there was a terrific thing on GBH last night. I don't know if any of you caught it. A new Ken Burns film spotlights little-known Holocaust rescuers. I'm going to share this information because hopefully this will be replayed. And it's really, I watched it actually twice because it was so compelling. In 1940, as he was being transported to safety in the lower deck of a ship, the Jewish author Leon Furtwängler asked Waitstill Sharp why the American Unitarian minister had bothered to rescue him from the Nazis. Sharp and his wife Martha had spent much of the previous 2 years smuggling Jews out of Nazi-controlled territory, saving people from persecution. The clergyman had told Furtwängler was what any able person should do. I think something frightful, in addition to what has befallen Europe, is going to befall now, Sharp later recalled saying, I'm not a saint. I'm just as capable of the sins of human nature as anyone else, but I believe that the will of God is to be interpreted by the liberty of the human spirit. It's an intimate moment in Defying the Nazis, The Sharps' War, a documentary co-directed by the renowned filmmaker Ken Burns that takes a highly personal look at the American Christian couple who left a quiet life in New England, traveled to Nazi-occupied Europe, and smuggled hundreds of Jews to safety. The movie, which relies on written collections of the Sharps, Waitstill is voiced by Tom Hanks, archival footage and interviews with survivors and historians, premieres September 20th on PBS. That was last night. It will also be screened for press at the White House next week, followed by a panel discussion on the current refugee crisis. Defying the Nazis is a change of pace for Burns, a director best known for sweeping documentaries on broad topics, see Civil War, jazz, or baseball. But when confronting the Holocaust's enormity, Burns said the best approach was to focus on narrow, resonant stories like that of the Sharps rather than statistics that can mask the pain of mass atrocity. The number 6 million has become rather opaque, Burns told JTA by phone from his office in New Hampshire. We just say it and it lacks dimension and specificity. Specificity. There we go. Here you have a story of two people who saved a few hundred people on the edges of that Holocaust. However, the final frame of Defying the Nazis dedicates the film to all the Holocaust victims who were not saved. If the finale does anything, it reminds us that those 6 million are an amputated limb whose lives we still miss and who ought to itch and bother us as long as we are human beings, Burns said. The film traces the story of the Sharps, who were living in Wellesley, Massachusetts, when the American Unitarian Association asked them to travel to Czechoslovakia in 1939 and France in 1940 to help people persecuted by the Nazis. The couple provided relief to embattled groups, raised money for refugee aid, and smuggled Nazi targets, including children, out of the country. They are two of the five Americans who have been inducted by Yad Vashem, the Israeli Holocaust Museum, as righteous among the nations. Burns became connected to the film through his co-director, Artemis Jukowski, the Sharp's grandson and a fellow alumnus of Hampshire College. Jukowski first showed the film to Burns 5 years ago, and Burns steadily became more involved, beginning as an informal advisor and ending as a co-director. Burns compared his evolving role in the film to dialing up the heat slowly on a frog in a saucepan. But this is a good kind of boil, he added. It's just firing on all cylinders, he said of the movie. You have a comfortable middle-class Unitarian minister and his wife who live in Wellesley, Mass. The most dramatic thing that happens is what he says on Sunday. They leave their small children behind, go to Prague on the eve of World War II. She's dodging various Gestapo agents at night. He's going to European capitals to launder money. In the film, much of Sharp's story is told through the memories of the now adult children the couple rescued. Burns said the childhood memories created the personal recollection necessary to capture the narrative's emotional atmosphere. Children make unusually accurate witnesses, he said. You really remember when your parents are happy, and you really, really remember when your parents are anxious and sad. The movie adds another personal touch as it turns away from the Sharps' rescue work and documents the rising tensions in the couple's marriage after they return to the States. Anyway, I'm not going to go into that so much. Burns said he isn't done with the Holocaust documentation. He's in the early stages of planning a movie about the U.S. role in preventing the Holocaust, a topic he says most people don't fully understand. And though his first allegiance in defying the Nazis was to telling an accurate story, he hopes viewers come away with a drive to do more for today's refugees. Well, I don't know as far as what the U.S. did to prevent the Holocaust. Not so much. Roosevelt had an opportunity to bomb the train tracks and stop the gassings, and they didn't do it. They didn't want to waste the bomb. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what he comes up with. So a couple of quick notes. Aardvark Jazz Orchestra is going to be performing at Scholars Jazz Club Thursday, September 29th. That's this Thursday. It's their season opener, 44th season, with vocalist Jerry Edwards and Grace Hughes at the Scholars Jazz Club on Soldiers Field Road. And if you'd like more information, this is the phone number, 617-562-4111 or scholarsjazz.com. Called Stunningly Beautiful and Adventurous New York City Jazz Record and one of the best ensembles in the world, Jazz Podium Germany. The Aardvark Jazz Orchestra kicks off its 44th season at Scholars Jazz Club with an exhilarating show including music from the band's latest CD, Passages, on the Leo Records label. Highlights from the disc include Mark Harvey's Saxophrenia and his piece Spaceways for Sun Ra. Also on tap, the world premiere of Mark Harvey's Northeast Express, plus the Duke Ellington Juan Tizol Classic Caravan, and the Duke Ellington Johnny Hodges Battle Jeep Blues. That sounds like a fabulous show. There's also going to be a December 10th Christmas concert at Emmanuel Church on Newbury Street. That'll be December 10th. So, I don't have my copy of their CD with me, but I have played it before. So, I think, let's see if there's anything else I need to announce. Well, I saw a terrific film over at the Kendall Square Cinema, and it is called Florence Foster Jenkins. Great story. Let's see how long that's going to be showing. Thursday, September 22nd. So it's got another two nights. Set in 1940s New York, Florence Foster Jenkins is the true story of the legendary New York heiress and socialite Meryl Streep, who obsessively pursued her dream of becoming a great singer. The voice she heard in her head was beautiful, but to everyone else it was hilariously awful. Her husband and manager, St. Clair Bayfield, Hugh Grant, an aristocratic English actor, was determined to protect his beloved Florence from the truth. But when Florence decided to give a public concert at Carnegie Hall, St. Clair knew he faced his greatest challenge, directed by Stephen Frears, Philomena. Anyway, it's absolutely exquisite. The settings, the costumes, the jewelry, and the music, besides her lovely screeching voice, which is based on the truth. Very interesting story. She was a patron to the arts, and so a lot of people who were quite well known and famous helped her because she funded their projects. So, let's see. All right, we're going to go to some more music here on the Voicemobile. I'm your host, Joyce the Voice.
Oh, mit Liebschaft will ich rufen dich, Mamele, beugen mir, schwach dein Hand, a golden heart zu sie und jedes Kind versteht. Ich gedenk, wie die Flexen mich beruhigen, a Kind von 3 Uhr bläus, ich darf dir sehen, wie die Flex mir setzen, damals läuft dein Scheuß. Mit der Gisch, ob Gewicht, jeden Träger weiß dein Kopf, wie Schnee, wo's fällt. Gott, wie ist die Bank, wo's die Welt greu und alt. Mamele, Mamele, sei gebenst vom Gott, Mamele. Verlich riefen dich, Mamele, Eugen mich, schwach dein Hand, a golden Herz aus dir und jedes Kind verstehst. Ich gedenk, wie die Flecken mich beruhigen, a Kind von 3 Uhr bläus, ich darf dir sehen. Wie die Flex mit Sätzen damals täuft dein Scheuß. Mit der Kisch, ob Gewicht, jeden Träger weiß dein Tag, wie Schnee, wo's fällt. Gott, wie ist die Band, wo's die Welt grauen hat. Mamele, sei gebenst für'n Gott, Mamele. Sei gebenst für'n Gott, Mamele.
Jan Pierce, wow, Mamele. And it's interesting, there is a new, well, it's been open a couple of months, a restaurant over in Kendall Square, and it's called Mamele's, and it's Jewish-style deli, and now I think they just opened up last night for dinner as well. They've been open for brunch, been there a couple of times. Food is great, and the service is great, and yeah. So, I want to share an article that's relevant to life here on campus at Tufts and any other campuses. There's a picture. It says, Boycott Israel. It's got a line through the Israeli flag. It's called, Jewish Pride on Campus is Under Siege, How Your Kids Can Fight Back. Here's what your kids can do to fight the big lie about Israel and keep their heads raised. It's by Arnold M. Eisen. It's dated 6/9/16, the JTA, Jewish Telegraph Agency. The writer is the chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary. Over 300,000 Jewish college students have arrived or will arrive shortly on American campuses. And what they experience there is likely not only to broaden their minds and uproot long-held assumptions, but shake their Jewish selves to the core. They will contend with powerful faculty and student voices, accusing them of complicity in a regime of privilege and oppression here in America and of colonialism, genocide, and apartheid in Israel. The boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement and its campus allies have had little impact thus far, either on the investments made by universities or the policies of the governments of Israel or the United States. They are, however, diverting enormous time and resources from important work of Jewish education and community building. No less important, they are causing untold numbers of students to keep their heads down where Israel and Judaism are concerned, and to feel ashamed when they have every reason to be proud. I'm not afraid that Jews or other college students will fall for the big lie about Israel. The world is a dangerous mess right now, nowhere more than in the Middle East. Simplistic narratives of good and evil like those propounded by the BDS movement are unlikely to prove persuasive to anyone who reads up on the matter or exercises their minds. But I do fear growing doubt among some Jewish undergraduates that the Jewish community and tradition are worthy of their involvement and commitment. I worry about increased suspicion, thanks in part to language endorsing BDS positions in the platform released by a coalition affiliated with the Black Lives Matter movement, that students can stand up for justice as Jews and can fight mass incarceration and racism as supporters of Israel. I want all to know that they can and should maintain deep ties to the Jewish community and tradition at the same time as they claim membership in larger communities and work alongside others for universal causes of justice and peace. My message to students this fall in particular is this: have pride in your Judaism. Learn about its history and Israel's. Keep your minds and hearts open. Maintain the moral courage to reject claims that Israel practices apartheid and genocide because they are unequivocally false. Work to create spaces on campus where one can openly and lovingly question choices and actions made by Israel's leadership and America's without giving up attachment to either. As Jews, we must stand beside those fighting against inequality and injustice, and should do so regardless of the incorrect views that others hold of Judaism and Israel. As a committed Jew, I am commanded to have unceasing concern for both Jewish learning and the struggle for justice. That same passion attracts me to the State of Israel, which I view as an attempt to translate age-old Jewish values into policy. This attempt, which will always fall far short of perfection, deserves our enduring support, and when necessary, our critique. Like any nation, Israel requires such challenge and correction if it is to remain true to its founding ideals. Israel has a lot to figure out, many wrongs to make right, incredible achievements on which to build, currents of bigotry to overcome, a proud tradition of democracy, the only one in the Middle East, to develop, and the hopes of many millions and many centuries that it dare not betray. But history shows that whenever people say that Jews or any other group are largely to blame for significant portions of the world's ills, or that things would be perfect if only Jews stopped insisting that we too have a right to live in the world, or that the Jewish state or the Jewish community has no right to exist unless it conforms to allegedly quote-unquote universal ideals demanded of no other people as a condition of legitimate survival, something is dangerously wrong. That point of view, which sadly has a long history behind it, must be resisted. Though they will hear its rhetoric and see its demonstrations, few students will ever visit the BDS website, where one learns that the movement is avowedly part of the Palestinian Arab national struggle against the very existence of the State of Israel. BDS materials say nary a word about the partial responsibility of the corrupt Palestinian government in the West Bank or the murderous Hamas regime in Gaza for the failure of the peace process thus far. One hears a great deal from BDS and affiliated groups like Jewish Voice for Peace about Jewish and Israeli culpability, but nothing about mistakes made on the Palestinian Arab side, oppression committed by it, the blatant anti-Semitism built into its policies and publications, cruel terror. BDS is silent about the many countries that are guilty of abuses far worse than those charged to Israel. Much of the Middle East is in flames. The Syrian death toll is past 400,000, and not a single Middle Eastern society guarantees equality and justice for all its citizens, women and men, Christian and Muslim, to anything like the degree that Israel does, however imperfectly. As we approach Rosh Hashanah, my hope for the new year is that no Jewish student leave Judaism behind in the name of universal ideals, or leave Israel behind in the name of Judaism. The world desperately needs the skills and knowledge they will acquire on campus. Judaism needs their passion, perspectives, and engagement. Israel needs their voices, proud and strong. An article by Arnold M. Eisen, the Chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary. And this is an article by, well, I'll wait just a minute before I do that. Let's hear some, let's see. I'll go here. La 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 la. Karlbach, Ata Becher Atanu, from Shlomo Karlbach, live in England. He does it like nobody else. Okay, so this is what I wanted to share with you. This is from, let's see, Giulio Miotti, 9/17/16, and it's called The Virtuous new Nazis. Instead of worrying about Islamist terrorism and Molenbeek, Brussels' nest of jihadists, there are racists in Europe who want to crush Israel, the only democracy in the Middle East. They all falsely claim to be a peaceful, using economic means to correct wrongs in the Palestinian territories. However, they never seem to try to correct any of the wrongs in the corrupt, repressive governments of the Palestinian Authority and Hamas in Gaza, or even to advocate there for a free press, for the rule of law, or for building a stable economy. Their true racist motives are unmasked. The pre or post 1967 lines are only an alibi for these new Nazis. Many consider Israel in its entirety illegal, immoral, or both, even though Jews have lived on that land for 3,000 years. Part of it is even called Judea. Their appetite for accusing Jews of having the audacity to, quote, occupy their own historical biblical land only reveals their collusion in the darkest lies of Islamic extremists who are trying to destroy the indigenous Christian Copts in their native land of Egypt and the indigenous Assyrian Christians whom we see being slaughtered throughout the Middle East. Should the French be accused of occupying Gaul? Just look at any map of Palestine, which blankets the entire state of Israel. To many Palestinians, all of Israel is a single giant settlement that has to be dismantled. Meet the packs of new Nazis posing as righteousness and virtue, pursuing new exterminationist policies against Israel, and right after that, the Jews. In Nazi Germany, noted Brendan O'Neill in the Wall Street Journal, it was all the rage to make one's town Judenfrei. Now a new fashion is sweeping Europe, to make one's town or city what we might call Zionist-fry, free of the products and culture of the Jewish state. Across the continent, cities and towns are declaring themselves Israel-free zones, insulating their citizens from Israeli produce and culture. It has ugly echoes of what happened 70 years ago. The Nazis said, Kauft nicht bei Juden, do not buy from Jews. The slogan of these new racists is, Kauft nicht beim Judenstaat, do not buy from the Jewish state. The Nazis repeated, Geh nach Palestine, du Jud, go to Palestine, you Jew. Racists in Europe shout, Jews out of Palestine. It's pretty revolting. All right, so we're going to go into a little bit different direction. Let's see. Let's go here.
Ashrei Yoshevei Veisecho Veisecho Od
sabero veato
Oh.
Adonishem Yedaber.
Cantor Ben Zion Miller, what a voice. This is the first Slichot. As I mentioned, Saturday night is the ushering in of the High Holy Days for the Jewish community. And there's a midnight service. This is according to the Orthodox and traditional ritual. Music by Yosla Rosenblatt, Israel Shore, Joshua Lind, and others. Skolika Hebraica. Neil Levin is the conductor. It's on the Milken Archive label. Just exquisite. So I want to share one more article by Professor Paul Eidelberg, The Left's Alliance with Despotism Then and Now. Prologue is British recognition of Palestinian statehood corresponds to British appeasement of Nazi Germany, which recalls the adage, plus ça change, plus ça la même chose. The more it changes, the more it is the same. British appeasement of despotism led to World War II. U.S. appeasement of Iran may lead to World War III. George Orwell attributed British appeasement of Nazi Germany in the 1930s to the pervasive doctrine of moral relativism, still propagated by English universities. The same relativism underlies U.S. appeasement of Iran and the Palestinians. Melanie Phillips excoriates relativism in her book, The World Turned Upside Down. The Global Battle Over God, Truth, and Power, 2010. So does Theodore Dalrymple, Our Culture, What's Left of It, 2005. During World War II, American-born William Joyce, known as Lord Haha, became a Nazi propaganda broadcaster to England. His job was to undermine English morale. He had unwitting, if not willing, allies among England's left. Prominent among England's anti-war protesters were intellectuals who hated Churchill. Haha was eventually captured and executed for treason by the British as a result of his wartime activities. More recently, in September 2010, an American convert to Islam, Adam Gadahan, who became an English language spokesman for Al-Qaeda in the United States, was indicted in absentia by a federal grand jury for treason, aiding and abetting Al-Qaeda. We have here a paradoxical phenomenon. Leftists, usually atheists, allied with Muslims. To understand this phenomena, we can hardly do better than study the letters and journalism of George Orwell. Although Orwell was, in sentiment, a socialist, he deplored England's left-wing intelligentsia, especially its academics. He scorned the emotional shallowness of intellectuals who live in the world of ideas and have little contact with physical reality. He saw that many intellectuals of the left were severed from the culture of their country, England, and said Orwell, is perhaps the only great country whose intellectuals are ashamed of their own nationality, precisely the feeling of many left-wing American professors. India-born Dinesh D'Souza cites numerous examples of this attitude among American academics, journalists, and other opinion makers. One American professor, Robert Jensen, said on the day after 9/11, we must say goodbye to patriotism because the world cannot survive indefinitely the patriotism of Americans. Oh my God. Political scientist Richard Berthold said, anyone who can blow up the Pentagon would get my vote. Good grief. Comedian Gian Garofalo recently said, when I see a gay parade in New York with naked men and women on a float cheering, we're here, we're queer, that's what makes my heart swell. Not the flag, but a gay, naked man or woman burning the flag, I get choked up with pride. Returning to England, the left persistently chipped away at English morale and regarded patriotism as an atavistic emotion. During the 1920s and 30s, the main object of the cultural left was to break down the feeling of patriotism. This encouraged self-indulgence and hedonism. Nazi Germany deemed England soft and decadent, hence that it was safe to plunge into war. The American cultural left is no less hedonistic. Neo-paganism is rampant in America. Now, only now, this neo-paganism, disseminated throughout the world by American pop culture, threatens tradition-based cultures like Islam and therefore provokes Islam's jihadic attacks against the United States. While Islam exalts war at any price, the cultural left exalts peace at any price. Pacifism and defeatism were rampant among the English intelligentsia. Orwell saw that people who started by renouncing violence often end up supporting Hitler. The opponents of England's involvement in the war simply lacked the intellectual courage to think through the practical consequences of their position. Their opposition to the war was objectively pro-fascist. One may say the same of today's cultural left in America, but let's probe deeper. The cultural left fears Christian more than Islamic fundamentalists. They see in religion a threat to unfettered personal freedom. For the cultural left, freedom means the absence of all external moral constraints. It is the freedom of depravity. This is what the cultural war in America is all about. A new morality is gaining ascendancy, the morality of moral depravity. How did this new morality become so powerful? After all, a majority of Americans support family values. Why don't the laws of the United States protect those values, these values? The answer is this. As in Israel, the cultural left has gained control of the judicial branch of government. It is the U.S. Supreme Court that decriminalized pornography and legalized same-sex marriages in the facetious name of human rights. A child no longer has a right to two parents. The court has made a mockery of the First Amendment by removing virtually all symbols of religion from the public domain, and without religion, there is no morality. No wonder Islam regards America as the great Satan. But now, Muslims see that the cultural left is only part of America, the part that threatens Islam. It is the cultural left that is seeking to spread homosexuality, same-sex marriage, and pornography throughout the world via various international organizations, including the UN. And so Islam sees in the cultural left an enemy as well as an ally. As an enemy, the cultural left is diametrically opposed to Islam. But since the atheistic left has become anti-American, it is the ally of Islam. Professor Paul Eidelberg, The Left's Alliance with Despotism Then and Now. Pretty interesting. All right, so here we go. Nope, not that. I want this one. Here we go.
Ahavta et Adonai Elohecha bechol levavcha uvechol nafshecha uvechol meodecha. Et Adonai Elohecha bechol levavcha uvechol nafshecha uvechol meodecha.